In this weekend episode, two segments from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this week. First, author and American University visiting law professor Kim Whaley discusses potential criminal referrals out of the January 6th committee, and oral arguments this week in the Supreme Court case Moore v. Harper on whether state legislatures have the unrestricted powers in how they administer federal elections. Then, Washington Times reporter Joseph Clark discusses Elon Musk's release of the so-called Twitter files about how the platform handled the Hunter Biden laptop story in the run-up to the 2020 election.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
First, a discussion of the legal news of the week, including a primer on the closely watched Supreme Court case Moore v. Harper and former President Trump's legal challenges.
Back at our table this morning, Kim Whaley, who's an ABC News legal contributor and also American University visiting law professor. Good morning. Thanks for being here. Let's talk about the Supreme Court case this week, the oral arguments in Moore v. Harper. What's this case about?
The case is about whether state legislators, that is the equivalent of members of Congress for states, can basically have the final say in federal elections. It's an interpretation of the Constitution, which says the time, place, and manner of federal elections shall be determined by state legislatures. And it's a really radical theory because essentially what's being argued here is that state court judges under state constitutions cannot hold state legislators accountable if they violate state constitutions. It's as I said, it's a really radical legal theory. It's kind of amazing it made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It has huge implications for voters, but it doesn't look like the court is going to take the radical view of the Constitution.
Well, let's get to that in a minute. But what's at the heart of this?
At the heart of it is a gerrymandered map in North Carolina. Gerrymandering is the process for determining how to carve up a state for purposes of federal elections to the United States Congress. The North Carolina legislature had their very gerrymandered map. That is, politicians are picking their voters, not the other way around. Both political parties do it. And the state court in North Carolina struck the map down as unlawful under North Carolina law. And now the legislature is coming to the Supreme Court, wanting the Supreme Court to say, essentially, whatever the legislature does stands, no matter how illegal it is under state law. So that's really what's at stake. But it goes beyond just gerrymandering. In theory, if the most extreme version were to hold, in theory, when it comes to the next presidential election, state legislatures could do whatever they want in picking electors for the presidency. So it has implications not just for North Carolina, not just for gerrymandering, but for federal elections that could go all the way to the White House.
The U.S. Constitution Elections Clause reads, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators." So how do you think the justices read this? And is this the important part of the Constitution in this case?
Well, amazingly, I think it surprises people that there's no affirmative right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. The language that you wrote, that you just read, basically says states decide their voting practices. This has nothing to do with state elections. What that says is even for federal elections, states decide how the electoral process works, but Congress can step in and change the rules. Like, we know we can register to vote at the DMV. That's a congressional statute. So here what's the Supreme Court is trying to decide whether when it comes to federal elections, what the legislature says is the bottom line. The word legislature, believe it or not, didn't just mean elected officials in a House of Representatives back at the time the Constitution was ratified and that language was created. It meant all kinds of politicians. And I think one of the wrinkles that arose for the challengers here, the people that want, the legislator that wants to say, listen, we have the final say, is that they admitted that, you know, a governor could veto something that the legislature did. And the Constitution creates the legislature. The Constitution creates all the parties of government. And so it's sort of bizarre to say once the Constitution creates a legislature, the legislature can be the boss of the Constitution. So it's a very thorny concept. I don't think, as I said, based on the oral argument, we can talk about which justices are lining up which way. I don't think that we're going to see, I doubt, you never know, a massive reshaping of the power of our electoral process, giving it to state legislatures.
Before we talk about which justices are lining up which way, I want you to listen and have our viewers listen to part of the oral argument. This is Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioning Timothy Moore's attorney, David Thompson, and taking issue with a portion of his argument. Take a listen.
Just going to ask, is your formalistic test just a way of trying to deal with our precedent, or are you rooting that in the Constitution itself? Because you do have a problem with explaining why these procedural limitations are okay, but substantive limitations are not.
Well, Your Honor, we certainly have tried to craft an argument that is consistent with all of the court's precedents. But we think that there are good reasons why there would be a substantive limitation, even if not a procedural limitation. We can see this in James Madison's remarks. I would refer the court to the third volume of Eliot's Debates, page 367, where James Madison laments partisan gerrymandering, and he singles out one state, South Carolina, for opprobrium for their partisan gerrymander. And their partisan gerrymander was found right in the state constitution. And that's the rule that my friends on the other side are advocating for. They're saying you can have a partisan gerrymander, but you have to put it in the state constitution.
So that's not so much your argument then, this procedural substantive distinction is not so much a matter of the text, but it's you're pulling some things from the history and saying, like, James Madison's comment supports this procedural substantive line.
Well, we ground it in precedent, Your Honor, and text and structure and history. So,
Kim Whaley?
Well, you know, Justice Barrett was a civil procedure professor like myself, and I think she went on to say, listen, that substance procedure distinction, they're essentially trying to say when it comes to procedure, we'll let the Supreme Courts of the states apply the Constitution. But when it comes to substance, it should stick with the legislature. She said, that's a hot mess. It's very complicated in other areas of the law, and you're just, you know, I'm paraphrasing the idea, you're just blowing up, you know, a whole can of worms here, and we'll be in court over and over and over again to try to define what that distinction is. So I think she is one of those swing justices that might not be willing to just go down this path, which is just a lot of new ambiguity for the Constitution.
Who are the other justices that may follow her or she's following them?
Well, Thomas and Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch have already shown support for that radical idea, the idea that the buck stops with legislatures, courts, and state constitutions cannot override a legislature. But Justices Kavanaugh, the Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Barrett, look like they're in the middle. And of course, the more moderate or progressive justices are, you know, squarely Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor want to stick with history and tradition, which has been going on for 233 years.
Wall Street Journal editorial board wrote this. Critics even claim that Moore v. Harper, could let a state legislature reverse the results of its presidential popular vote. But the U.S. Constitution says Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors. And federal law says that that's election day. A state legislature can't take back presidential electors after the fact. Any attempt would be a loser in federal court. Despite what you might hear, Moore v. Harper has nothing to do with Donald Trump.
You know, that's a really complicated question, but it really boils down to something called the Electoral Count Act. That is this really old statute that the Congress right now is thinking about amending. And if you take the Constitution and you combine it with that old statute, I disagree. I do think there's already, even without this case coming out in the radical way, there's already sort of room between the November election and December for a state legislature to meet and say, we don't care what the voters said. We're going to pick who our electors are going to which candidate, and those are the ones that the Congress would have to gavel in January, absent some real problem.
When do you think we'll hear a decision on this from the Supreme Court?
I think the expectation is June. You know, early summer is where we hear all kinds of things, and it's not the only big case pending this year again before the Supreme Court.
Some others?
We have a case on affirmative action, whether essentially the court's going to hold that it's unconstitutional to consider race in an application. That's a big deal. We have a case on whether you have a constitutional First Amendment right to refuse to serve LGBTQ clients, notwithstanding a state law protecting against discrimination on the basis of gay and lesbian status. But also, I think it could bleed into things like race, that there would be a constitutional right under the First Amendment to discriminate on the basis of race in terms of your speech. Those are just two examples. There are others having to do with the scope of presidential power. That is, can states come in and sue a president to say, listen, what you're doing under federal law is affecting our budget. So if the court in two cases were to say, yeah, states can do that, we'd see a lot of second guessing and a lot of political, I think, lawsuits filed against whichever political party controls the White House. It's again a very rare area, time in American history when it comes to constitutional law. Really, really interesting stuff for someone in my seat.
So to our viewers, you can call in with any questions or comments that you heard so far this morning in our conversation with Kim Whaley. She's, as we said, ABC News legal contributor, also law professor, visiting law professor at American University, here to talk about these legal issues. Another one is the January 6th committee considering criminal referrals to the Justice Department. What is the significance of this?
Nothing when it comes to actual criminal activity. So the Congress cannot bring criminal charges against anybody. But I do think it's somewhat symbolic and educational. I mean, I've said before, I think a big role of the January 6th committee is to educate the public through the hearings. We'll have now a big report, because the idea of potentially, even theoretically, indicting a former president is so substantial and significant for our history and for precedent that I think sort of laying out the evidence that the Congress developed against Donald Trump, and then CNN reports probably four of his close advisors might be in that group where they would refer, make criminal references.
The former president as well?
The former president, Donald Trump, as well as Mark Meadows, Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, and Jeffrey Clark, that sort of people reading and talking about that would almost give some, sort of warm people up to the idea that this might be coming down the pike through special counsel Jack Smith. But they cannot actually. DOJ could just completely ignore what Congress does and not take any action whatsoever.
So does this go to Merrick Garland, or does this go to the special counsel?
I think at this point, based on the referral by Merrick Garland to the special counsel, this would be within the power of the authority of the special counsel, that as well as the Mar-a-Lago documents that were taken out of the White House.
Why is that?
Because the way the regulation works, so just so people are clear, the special counsel kind of takes Jack Smith out of the direct line of command to Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland can step in, but has to sort of explain to Congress why he might interfere with what Mr. Smith does, but the referral gives the topics that he's responsible for. One is January 6th, but only the top brass in January 6th, the people at the Capitol, the 900-plus people that have been now in the criminal justice system, that stays with the local U.S. Attorney's Office here in Washington. And then the second big topic that's been carved out from main justice to Jack Smith is the Mar-a-Lago document investigation.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This week, Jack Smith asked officials in three states for communications with former President Trump. From a legal standpoint, What does that mean for his investigation?
It means that one of the things he's looking at is the attempt to have the states create fake slates of electors to send to the United States Congress. And just, again, so we're really clear, it's illegal for you or me to vote fraudulently. It's certainly illegal to come up with fake slates of electors to dupe the United States Congress into gaveling in someone who was not elected by the people pursuant to the law. So that is, who, if it happened, it's against the law, and I think that's what these subpoenas go towards.
Front page of the Washington Post this morning, DOJ asks judge to hold the Trump team in contempt. The prosecutors have urged a federal judge to hold Donald Trump's office in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a May subpoena in return to return all classified documents in his possession. Why is this significant?
Well, documents keep trickling in from Donald Trump, and DOJ has asked for, you know, a couple years now, and there have been assurances over and over that you have everything, and I think just last week there were more that came out. What the DOJ wants is an affirmative statement from what we call a records custodian from the Trump team that says you have everything. The Trump team is saying, listen, we don't want to say that. We'll say we've done a diligent search, but we don't want to say that you have everything because you never know. And the DOJ is saying, we're tired of this. You're not complying with our subpoenas. You're not willing. You're getting a little cute about this, and we're tired of it. We want to know we have everything. Because you're not complying, we want the judge to hold you in contempt, which could be, you know, a fine or something every day until they actually certify that they've turned everything over that was illegally taken from the White House.
That was author, law professor, and ABC News legal analyst Kim Whaley. Next, Joseph Clark from The Washington Times on Elon Musk releasing the so-called Twitter files, internal documents relating to how the platform handled stories about Hunter Biden in the lead-up to the 2020 elections.
Joseph Clark is with us this morning. He writes for The Washington Times, a Capitol Hill reporter, here to talk about Elon Musk, the owner of Twitter, and his release of the so-called Twitter files. Joseph Clark, why are they being called the Twitter files?
It's actually a full release. He claims, or he's proposing, of just documents, answering questions that people have had about Twitter over the years. There's been a lot of questions about specifically Twitter's decision to suppress stories related to the Hunter Biden laptop. So. Elon Musk, that was his first tranche of documents that he has released. Last night, he released more files related to Twitter's blacklisting, if you will, or suppression of certain voices, certain accounts. And so it really fits in with his claim of his goal of creating a more robust, free environment at Twitter. That's part of the reason why he took over the platform, he says. And so this is kind of his first foray in doing that.
A lot of attention being paid to how Twitter treated the 2020 New York Post story about Hunter Biden's laptop. What do these internal deliberations reveal about that?
Yeah, so there was no question that they did suppress, you know, the stories related to the laptop before the election. So the New York Post story was published mid-October of 2020 going into the election. And so what these documents that were released through independent journalist Matt Taibbi on an extensive Twitter thread reveal just kind of the conversations that were going on around that decision, right? And so that points to, you know, what was... Why did the executives make that decision to do so? There were also some other interesting, pieces of that decision that came in. So we saw debate from Congressman Ro Khanna, Democratic congressman from California. He weighed in on the decision as it was going on. So that was interesting to see. But Matt Taibbi also reveals that, there was a kind of a backroom communication conduit for, well-positioned people in politics to kind of contact Twitter executives and to suppress certain information that they didn't want, you know, to take off on the platform. So it was already known that this was occurring on, or this had occurred on Twitter, but this revealed kind of the discussions going into that and why that decision was made.
Jack Dorsey, who started Twitter, tweeting at Elon Musk yesterday, if the goal is transparency to build trust, why not just release everything without filter and let people judge for themselves, including all discussions around current and future actions? Make everything public now.
Yeah, that's an argument being made not only by Jack Dorsey, but, you know, some on the conservative side are also making that argument. Miranda Devine, who's at the New York Post, who's been, you know, following the story, has also, you know, called for the same thing. So, and I understand the argument. So imagine that, though. This would be, how would you do that? You know, would you just put this on online, you know, somewhere, and then is it over to the public to go through and to, you know, ask the questions to the data set and then find answers? What he's doing now, I get what he's doing. He's doing this through two independent journalists, Matt Taibbi and Barry Weiss, two very respected, long careers. And so it's kind of a curation. So, you know, they're going through pulling the information and then kind of telling a story through Twitter.
On Twitter threads that are 35, you know,
plus right.
tweets.
And with screenshots of the documents that kind of back up the statements that they're making in their reports. So it is insight for the public to see this. Elon Musk said on a Twitter Q&A over the weekend that he was considering just a full release of the information of the documents. But if you can imagine, you know, what would that look like? What exactly do you just pull down computers from the years before he, you know, took the platform over? I mean, just millions of emails and put them online, you know. So there are questions. You could release so much information that people wouldn't be able to, you know, decipher anything from it.
One of Matt Taibbi's tweets, number 24, here's a quote. They just freelanced it, referring to the Hunter Biden story, is how one former employee characterized the decision. Hacking was the excuse, but within a few hours, pretty much everyone realized that wasn't going to hold, but no one had the guts to reverse it. Remind our viewers about this New York Post story just right before the 2020 election. What was at the heart of it?
So at the heart of the New York Post story, so if we go back, the story was derived from a laptop that Hunter Biden left at a Delaware computer repair shop that was turned over to Rudy Giuliani and Steve Bannon, I believe, was involved sending it to the Post. So the key question that they answered in their, or the question that they got at in the article is whether President Biden himself had any knowledge or any involvement in Hunter Biden's business deals. And there were emails to suggest that he did know, he was introduced to these people, and he had said, you know, previously on the campaign trail that he had nothing to do with those business dealings. So, but what Matt Taibbi says, they freelanced the decision. I think that's the more interesting piece of this, right? So they were referring to Twitter internal policy about how to deal with hacked materials, right? So there's this difference between the First Amendment and Twitter policy, right? Obviously, you would hope that Twitter policy would be guided by the First Amendment, but they're a private company. And so they make their decisions. But what we saw in those conversations was that there was this, it seemed like there was this intent to suppress the information, and how did that intent fit into their policy? And that's what they kind of freelanced. You know, they found out that, hey, this probably isn't hacked material. This could actually be a legitimate, you know, laptop that, you know, was obtained legitimately. And so the reasoning of, hey, this violates our hacked policy, your hacked materials policy, kind of just fit their true, you know, desire to just, you know, tamp it down.
So what did they do once they decided that this was the route they were going to take? What did they do on Twitter to try to block the story?
So they blocked or suspended Kayleigh McEnany's account. She was the White House press secretary at the time. They would suppress the story, so, you know, cancel tweets. I believe the New York Post's account itself was at one point caught up in this. So it was an effort to you know, completely silence the story and other conversations related to the story. So it was a matter of, let's keep this off the platform. We don't want it to trend ahead of the election.
What was the company hearing from the Biden campaign? What kind of requests did the Biden campaign have, and other Democrats as well?
So that's another interesting point. So what we see from the Biden campaign specifically in Matt Taibbi's first thread is an email from October 24th. So that's 10 days after the article was published in the New York Post, but still leading up to the election and while this was going on, right? So while this decision-making and this effort to suppress the story was going on, and there was an email between Twitter employees it stated that the Biden administration had, the Biden team, quote, had reached out to block a list of accounts that they said, you know, were problematic for some reason or another. That same email thread shows that...
Were they trying to have the company take down nude photos of Hunter Biden? Is that their request?
It's not clear. Oh. Right. It's not clear what exactly they were requesting to be taken down from Matt Taibbi's tweet and from the screenshot. But it was a list of accounts, and not posts, but accounts, that they wanted to suspend. Twitter did so and responded that, you know, this is taken care of. Importantly, I should point out that while Matt Taibbi says that the Biden administration did this, they also did the same thing for other well-connected people in the Republican Party. He said that the Trump campaign or the Trump insiders reached out to suppress accounts. The same thing, and those were in some cases followed through. Twitter employees would actually do so. But he said, you know, those decisions largely skewed in favor of Democrats or more liberal-leaning people.
So you had well-connected actors or well-known actors. You had lawmakers on both sides of the aisle reaching out. Twitter would comply. Did Twitter hear from intelligence officials or government agencies?
Right. And so that's another interesting point to this. And I think more will come out on this. In Matt Taibbi's Twitter thread, he specifically says that from the documents that he viewed, there was no interference or direct injection of federal officials into the conversation. That being said, I should point out a couple things. We know from an FEC filing that Yoel Roth, a Twitter executive in charge of platform safety, made to the FEC right after the election in 2020. He said that since 2018, he was involved along with other social media executives from other platforms in weekly regular meetings with representatives, officials from the ODNI, Office of Director of National Intelligence, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security to discuss safety issues, misinformation, disinformation. Specifically leading up to the election, they cued the executives to potential hacking operations. And specifically in this FEC filing, he mentions that they suggested that there would be a specific hack targeting Hunter Biden leading up to the election. So there's no, in Matt Taibbi's first dump of documents, there's no back and forth between, you know, the FBI and Twitter executives in these documents, but we do know that that took place. And Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO, has also said on Joe Rogan that, you know, he did make the decision, or Facebook did make the decision, to tamp down the story on his platform because of those meetings, because they were cued to the fact that there could be this Russian or foreign, you know, actors trying to influence the election.
Jack Dorsey testified before Congress. He admitted then that it was a mistake to censor this story. You've had reaction from some conservatives saying this is a nothing burger, to quote one of them, about the so-called Twitter files. Why?
Well, well, part of it is because this was all known that they did this, right? I think if you look at it as, you know, did something happen that we didn't know about in these files? Well, no, we knew about that. What's interesting, though, is when you look at the back and forth, why did this happen, right? I think that's where the story is. And I think it opens up these larger questions about what do we do with these platforms? I mean, we should realize that, hey, this is a new phenomenon, right? I mean, these are larger questions about how do we operate in this new paradigm, and what does it mean? What are the implications for the First Amendment? And I think that's why specifically Congressman Khanna's, you know, emails to the platform are most interesting, because you see that debate playing out in real time and attacking these problems that cross, you know, First Amendment, you know, in very real and nuanced ways that I think is more interesting.
That was Joseph Clark, who covers Capitol Hill for The Washington Times. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.